You're listening to the station that takes you off the beaten track from the University of Victoria, CFUV, 101.9 FM, 104.3 on cable, and on the internet, cfuv.uvic.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, President Obama continued last week to play his cards close to his chest concerning the expected expansion of American military forces sent into Afghanistan. For weeks, speculation has been rife in the media, most outlets concentrating not on the question of the wisdom of broadening fighting, but only of by how much it should be broadened. For them, it is a numbers game. Meanwhile, other NATO members are facing pressure to increase too their fighting forces there. Beyond speculation regarding the most practical way to run the occupation of that benighted nation, questions of the ultimate goals and practical effects of the 8-year-old mission remain unaddressed in either Washington or Brussels. Ann Jones is an educator, freelance journalist and photographer, author, and human rights advocate. Her book titles include Uncle Tom's Campus, When Love Goes Wrong, Women Who Kill, Next Time She'll Be Dead, Look Out for Lovadoo, and Kabul in Winter, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan. Her forthcoming book, War Is Not Over When It's Over, will be released next year. Ann Jones in the first half. And Bill C-6 has passed first reading in the Canadian Senate. A draconian bill is on its face, a measure to empower Health Canada in its efforts to protect Canadians from dietary supplements making bogus health claims. But the overbroad language of the bill and over-the-top military-style raids against mom-and-pop home businesses already conducted by the RCMP have many worried C-6 is little better than the not-so-thin wedge of the fascist state in Canada. Blair Longley is an author, activist, whose book titles include Megasynthesis and Letters Home from Oedipus. He's also the leader of Canada's Parti Marijuana, or the Marijuana Party, and has recently written about Bill C-6 and its pernicious potential for Canadian democracy. Blair Longley and Health Canada's jackboot in the door of Canadian rights and freedoms in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with goings on our city streets. But first, Ann Jones and Washington's imaginary friends in Afghanistan. Stick around. All said about Ann Jones, I'm afraid I can't get a hold of Ann, but I do have a tape of an interview I did with Ann a few years ago. Now, this might seem dated, but oddly enough, it isn't. Nothing has changed for the better, at least in Afghanistan, since I last spoke to Ann Jones. And so here she is, and I will try to rebook her again because she has just returned from Europe, and I'm kind of concerned about where she is. Now, I'm going to play this a shortened version of this interview I did in September 2006 with Ann, but it'll be a shortened version because Zoe Blunt, intrepid local investigative journalist, is going to come on and talk a little bit about what's going on as we come closer to the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver and the issues surrounding that. So stick around. But first, Ann Jones from 2006.
Thank you.
Well, now, Anna, Canadians now, this is kind of a touchy subject, and just before I went to air, I read something about this, but this is, as I've scripted it, I've said Canadians have a very limited understanding of just what their government is trying to do in Afghanistan, but that misunderstanding is somewhat fostered and is somewhat fraudulent, depending on whose propaganda you're listening to. But really, Anna, as someone who's been there yourself, what do you think, how do you feel that... And what is your assessment of the effects of international intervention in Afghanistan?
Well, let's say that depends on which nationals of the international intervention you're talking about.
Right.
I spent 4 winters in Afghanistan beginning in 2002, and that was not all that long after the U.S. Bombed the country to smithereens in what they described as a search for Osama bin Laden, though how you catch a few guys on the ground with high altitude bombing is something I haven't been able to figure out. Since that time...
Well, now shut my mouth because just on the telephone now joining me is Ann Jones live. Hi, Ann. How's it going?
Hi, all right.
Okay, we're now...
Sorry if we missed a connection here.
Well, yeah, okay, well, that's okay. Now, you're just back, Anne, from Sweden, where there was a conference going on concerning Afghanistan, and I know you've been there recently since we last talked. First of all, what was the conference in Sweden all about?
Well, it was a group called Sweden-Afghanistan Solidarity, that was formed during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan to protest against that occupation. And now they've revived themselves to protest the NATO occupation of Afghanistan. And in particular, they're trying to convince their own surprisingly conservative government to withdraw Swedish soldiers and devote that money to continuing the very, very excellent Swedish humanitarian effort there. Unlike the United States, Sweden has not been involved in a war in over 200 years, and they pride themselves on being a non-aligned, very peaceful country, and maintaining that position so that they'll be in a position to try to negotiate differences between other countries. And the people who are heading up this drive now in Sweden, which, by the way, is led by a former minister of defense, are very concerned that Sweden's reputation suffers by this first-time participation of their soldiers in a war. They usually only go to peacekeeping operations. And although the official Swedish government defines what they're doing in Afghanistan as peacekeeping, clearly that's not the case.
Well, it sounds to me that Sweden is now where Canada was 5 or 8 or 10 maybe years ago. I guess before Canada decided to drop bombs on Yugoslavia, the first time Canada had done such a thing since the Second War, at least. On the street now, I mean, the involvement in Afghanistan has never been popular in Canada, not the first day, and it's less so today. What do the people in Sweden have to say about the involvement in this war?
Well, I think that popular opinion in Sweden is certainly coming around to that perspective and wanting their soldiers out. And I also, I was in Afghanistan this summer, and I spent a little time in London on the way back, and I must say that there's a real outcry in Great Britain to pull the British soldiers out, and I think you see that reflected recently. You know, Gordon Brown said that he was going to continue to support the effort in Afghanistan, and then he committed another 500 troops, mm-hmm. and of course the U.S. had asked for thousands. So I think you're seeing a groundswell now of the countries involved in Afghanistan wanting to get their troops out, realizing that after 8 years, you know, with very little progress, that the military is never going to find a solution to this. It seems to just make matters worse.
Well, and in Canada, the state media and the corporate media are both unabashed supporters of this war and occupation. They say, and it's a difficult argument to counter, that, well, Afghanistan badly needs reconstruction, and we have the provincial reconstruction teams, but they can't do anything without a military supporting them. This is how most attacks against Canada's involvement in this are blunted. What about that, Anne? What about the provincial reconstruction teams, and how effective are they, and are they really worth all it takes to protect their work?
No, the provincial reconstruction teams have been a bad idea from the very beginning. And I think they get worse and worse. I don't mean to insult the troops who are involved in trying to do provincial reconstruction. They're soldiers who are trying to do their duty. And the duty that's been assigned to them on top of soldiering is delivering aid. And that is not the job of soldiers. They're not trained for it. They already have plenty to do without taking on that task as well. And all this has done is to blur the traditional division, the traditional separation between soldiers who were fighting for one side or another and humanitarian workers who, like the Red Cross, were working for humanity in general and were not taking sides. It's gotten a lot of humanitarian workers killed, for one thing. The other thing is that the PRTs are trying to do development where they are, in these outposts in the middle of nowhere. There's no reason that humanitarian aid and development aid can't be delivered, as it has been all along, by non-governmental organizations who are skilled at doing this, and that work can be done in the safer areas, in the urban areas, in several of the provinces where there is not a great deal of hostility. But the idea that you move development, you put development aid into the hands of the military and move them out into areas of great conflict and then think that they're going to do some kind of development there is ridiculous. And mostly what they wind up doing is building roads, because that's one thing they know how to do, and it's very convenient for them. They need the roads to get their supplies in and out. So you have a lot of roads being built in near PRT bases all across Afghanistan. The Afghans cannot possibly maintain them, nor do they necessarily even want them. They're not about to go anywhere. And, of course, the other problem is that whenever you bring troops in, Afghan women are immediately confined to their homes. So here we are with delivering aid man-to-man from our predominantly male soldiers to the male elders of a village. And incidentally, they often get altogether the wrong guys, and they're delivering aid to warlords. And simply confirming the idea that Afghan men already have, that women don't count for anything. So I think I've just given you about 8 or 10 reasons why this whole notion of PRTs is a catastrophically bad idea. And it won't surprise you to know that it was originally the idea of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. I'm speaking tonight with Ann Jones, and Ann is a educator, freelance journalist and photographer, author, and human rights advocate. Her book titles include Uncle Tom's Campus, When Love Goes Wrong, Women Who Kill, Next Time She'll Be Dead, Looking for Love Ado, and I know I'm saying that wrong, Ann, like I did the first time we were on, and Kabul in Winter, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan. Her forthcoming book, War Is Not Over, When It's Over, will be released next year. Now, Ann, of course, helping the women was a big raison d'etre for sending Canadian troops into Afghanistan, as it was for the Russian, or the Soviet Union, rather, when they sent troops into Afghanistan so many years ago. The plight of women, Ann, is it helped or hindered by this this lengthy occupation?
Well, that's a good question, and I think one reason people are reluctant reluctant to have the possibility of losing to the Taliban is the fear that women will be returned to that previous state. For the first few years after the overthrow of the Taliban, things seemed to get better, at least for women in the cities, where they could go back to work and go back to school. Of course, a lot of girls and boys went back into school. The Constitution called for equal rights. Women took seats in the parliament. So it looked like they were really on their way to getting ahead. Although I have to say that none of this affected the women in the countryside who continued to live and still do live much as they did during the Taliban times. Little has changed for them. But in the last 3 or 4 years, things have started to go backwards again for Afghan women. And one big reason for it, I think, is that this Karzai government that we put into place has really done nothing for women. It has not supported women's rights in any way. And so the Taliban has engaged in a series of assassinations of women who have been active in public life. And the government has offered no protection to women, even though it knows that those who are active in public life are in terrific danger. So, and then recently, of course, the Karzai government, or President Karzai himself, put through this infamous Shiite personal status law, which got a lot of attention in our press as the marital rape law, that really just takes away most of the rights that should be guaranteed to women of Shiite persuasion, and runs absolutely contrary to the guarantees of the Constitution and of all the international human rights agreements that Afghanistan has signed off on. It's a law that might have been put in place by the Taliban, and President Karzai just sneaked it in there illegally 3 weeks before the election, thinking that the West was in no position to take him on at that point when they were so concerned about having the election go through without a hitch. And that's exactly what happened. So women have been betrayed right down the line. And currently, with the parliament really in the hands of fundamentalist warlords, all of President Karzai's cronies, the women in parliament are afraid even to protest against these things because they've been so intimidated. Women journalists have also been very intimidated. Some have been killed. So it's not a good time for women. And the presence of troops, the continuance of the occupation, does nothing to make that situation any better, because these questions are a matter of governance. They're a matter of leadership that will stand up for human rights and that will set an example of human rights. They're a matter of a responsible judiciary, which will prosecute those who try to infringe the rights of women. But none of this exists in Afghanistan, and no progress has been made toward a reasonable judiciary and a fair government in all these years.
Yeah, I had the opportunity a number of years ago to speak with Afghani MP Malala Joya, who was here in Victoria, and she said much the same thing, that if the military is to stay, the Western military forces are to stay in her country, it can be nothing but disaster, and better that they just leave and let let Afghanistan sort out its own internal problems. It, of course, the United States and your country has been the lead on this this eight-year-long war and occupation in Afghanistan. Senator Kerry has come out strongly against the election process, and now it seems that President Karzai, his election results are being overturned due to fraud. Where this goes, I'm not sure. And Kerry was saying it was ridiculous for Obama to decide to increase forces, American forces, in the country until they knew who the government was. What about Abdullah Abdullah and the other presidential candidate? Is he discernibly different from Karzai? Or are we just fighting over who's going to be America's man in Afghanistan?
Well, you'll get different opinions on that. Malala Joya and the women of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Afghan Women, would tell you that he's just another warlord like Karzai, though his ancestry is half Tajik, and he's associated with the Northern Alliance rather than with the Pashtuns as Karzai is. I see it a little bit differently because I've interviewed Dr. Abdullah several times, and at the time that he was foreign minister, he appointed an Afghan-American woman who was extremely competent and skilled as his deputy in charge of women's affairs. And he worked very actively with her to try to appoint women as ambassadors to other countries and to really involve women in foreign affairs. He was the only cabinet minister, the only member of the government who actively worked to involve women in the political process. And to me, that was very impressive. So I like to think that he might be a little different. He's also known as a man of great integrity. And President Karzai may have started out as a man of integrity until he saw how corrupt the American system of aid and contracting was and figured out that maybe he better make a little money for himself, and his government became thoroughly corrupt. So there might be a possibility of some change with Dr. Abdullah. But I think what they're pushing for now is not a rerun of the election, because that would cost the international community another $500 million, and there's no guarantee that the election process would be any more credible than the first round was. I think they're working very hard behind the scenes to push President Karzai into a power-sharing arrangement with Dr. Abdullah, and perhaps also involving Ashraf Ghani, the fourth ranking candidate, who is also a man of great integrity and a known quantity, who actually would be capable of managing the finances of the country.
Well,
we'll see what happens.
Well, and finally, and I'm sorry our time is so short here, but you mentioned the unpopularity of the war amongst the Swedes and I amongst the Canadians. It's also unpopular in Britain, as you mentioned, and it's unpopular in Italy, it seems, and Germany. It seems unpopular everywhere with everyone taking part. What about in the United States, Anne? Is there any indication that Obama's so-called good war is starting to fade, the enthusiasm for it in the United States is starting to fade, and perhaps America might consider extricating itself anytime soon?
I think that people are turning against that involvement, absolutely, in greater numbers. I wouldn't go so far at this point as to call for any sort of precipitous withdrawal because, you know, we did break that country with George W. Bush, and we have, I think, some responsibility for trying to leave it with some sort of stability. So I wouldn't be in favor at this moment in time of absolutely abandoning it. But I certainly am part of that growing number of Americans who feel that we definitely should not send any more troops.
Well, Anne Jones, thanks a lot for coming on the show again. And you can check out Anne's book, Kabul in Winter, A Life Without Peace in Afghanistan. Her forthcoming book out in 2010 is War Is Not Over, When It's Over. Thanks a lot again for joining us, Anne.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Now, please stick around. I'm going to scare up Zoe in just a second, and we're going to talk a little bit about what the 2010 Olympics mean for Vancouver and environs and the people who are opposed to it. Stick around for that. It's Spiral Beach, the only real thing behind me, another new disc here in the CFUV library. Joining me now is Zoe Blunt. Hey, Zoe, how's it going?
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure always, Zoe, as you well know. And now I'm going to rush you right through this, though. Anne did get a hold of me, so our little backup plan didn't work. But tell me quickly now, the Anti-Olympics Festival, October 30th, it's 2 p.m. at Centennial Square. It's called the Spirit Square now, I see. What's it about, Zoe?
We are hosting a community festival in opposition to the torch relay and to speak out against the amazing, outrageous waste of resources that the torch relay is, and to assert our charter rights in speaking out for injustice in Canada.
Well, Zoe, and you've made T-shirts and bandanas as well, because there's the free speech zone doesn't recognize that, hey, in Canada, everybody is individually a free speech zone, are they not?
Right, here in Victoria, you know, everybody's going to be watching this, Chris, because we're going to be the first day of the actual 2010 Olympics, the start of the torch relay, right here. And so it's going to be a real test. And the city of Victoria has said they can set aside some protest areas for us, and we've declined their offer. We are going to use Centennial Square and the little Spirit Square, which is now part of Centennial Square. We're planning to set up in that whole public space, and we are the public, and we're exercising free speech and free association, and kind of in defiance of what's been hinted at, that there is going to be a crackdown. You know, as I think if we assert ourselves that we can, we can defend our rights and have a great community celebration.
Well, Bill 13 was brought up in Vancouver and the areas that they, I noticed, call the Olympic municipalities, that is, municipalities that have venues in them on the mainland where people can have their doors, maybe not kicked in, not yet, but if they have a banner in their window or on their property that is less than laudatory of the Olympic Olympics, this five-ring circus, as it's been called, they can be attacked. Is there an indication that there's some Bill 13-like legislation for areas where the torch relay is going to run through?
That's really unclear to us, but it seems that it would be bound by the same general guidelines that VANOC has imposed elsewhere. And, yes, they have imposed it in Vancouver. And, yes, the Civil Liberties Association, BC Civil Liberties Association lawyers, have filed a lawsuit against the city to strike down those bylaws as being against the charter.
Yeah, well, this is we saw it when the Olympics, the Summer Olympics, were in China, and it seems that this is just the way it goes. And the Olympic Committee, and of course the Vancouver's representatives of the same, are you know, everywhere the Olympics goes, nary a discouraging word is allowed to heard allowed to be heard on pain of prosecution, it seems. Now, tell me, and I'm sorry, Zoe, that our time is a little bit shorter than it would be, but how do people that want to find out more about both the Anti-Olympic Festival this October 30th at 2 p.m. starting in Centennial Square and the Zombie March to follow, where they can find out more about that and other issues that you guys are working on?
You can check our website at www.no2010victoria.com. And, sorry, I think it's no2010victoria.net. There we go. And, yeah, we're starting the day with legal observer training. We'll have a festival in the afternoon and then wrap up with a zombie march in the evening, the day before Halloween, October 30th.
Well, and as you say, Zoe, the outrageous amount of money that's being spent on the, you know, bread and circuses is one thing, but I mean, supersede are the rights that so many Canadians presumably went and fought and died for, as they always say, and as they're trying to bring to Afghanistan, as they tell us, can be swept aside so easily for this dog and pony show is absolutely disgusting in my view, but
right.
There you go. Okay, well, Zoe, we're going to have to hook up again and do a more full-fleshed version of the issues involved here, but sadly we can't do that today. But thanks a lot for coming on again, Zoe.
Sure, thank you.
All right, then. Now, I want you to stick around. I'm going to take another brief break, and I'll play a little bit more from this new disc here, Spiral Beach, while I try to get a hold of Janine, and she's going to talk to us, hopefully, and bring us up to speed with what's going on your streets here in Victoria. So do stick around. CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else. Playing behind me is Domino After Midnight. That's from Spiral Beach, the only real thing, a new disc here in the studio. Joining me now, as oft times she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine, how's it going?
Okay, I see that you were the number one Google News guy on the weekend.
Canada's Google page, one of my articles at pacificfreepress.com, where you can find many of those. You got picked up as number one. And, I'm still trying to deflate my head, but... But, you know, whenever something like that happens, I tell you, you see that the traffic to your website go, you know, really balloons. And, so I'm thankful for that. But, enough about me though.
Well, about time to hack into your website again and crash.
It might be. I tried to bring it up here from the studio and it's still spinning. So, maybe they're back on me again.
Well, you know, you're doing something right then. Listen, I hate to tell you, but I did not go to the rallies on the big, pouring, rainy day Saturday, Chris. So I cannot report from either the poverty rally or the wilderness rally. You know, after I spent a month with that flu, and I still am feeling the effects in my chest, I must say. So I sort of stayed away. But I can tell you about something, an interesting Facebook project that's going on.
Oh, yes. What's that?
Well, you know, in Vancouver also deals with tremendous amounts of homelessness, and somebody has started a 2010 homelessness hunger strike relay. So it sort of goes in similar to the torch relay where, you know, people take a week. So they're on week 42 now, and they put a little video of the person up who's embarking on the relay, and then they seem to be showing videos of the people after they complete their week. And what they're asking for is to reinvigorate the 1% solution. I remember Tucker Gomberg spoke about the 1% solution, and other politicians have, where basically we just need 1% of the federal dollars to go to housing. The housing, federal housing, has been cut. The National Social Housing Program was cut in 1993. We now have 150,000 homeless people in Canada. That's a low estimate. Others say it's between 200 and 300,000. And just with winter coming on again, I just can't imagine that we Canadians are going to allow this to happen, right? I mean, we don't cringe at the idea of socialism, do we? I mean, we're here to look after each other. They've shut down 1,300 single occupancy rooms in the downtown east side to make way for housing for the Olympic, visitors. Homelessness has doubled in Vancouver since 2002, and Indigenous people make up about 32% of that population. So, you know, it's really a national problem. And so this homelessness hunger strike relay on Facebook looks like an interesting thing to participate in.
Well, you know, and I'm looking at the Martlet, and the Martlet is the newspaper produced here, right across the hall from the studios here, up at the University of Victoria. And there is I've lost the page here, but oh yes, the Olympics are about athletes. This is in the op-ed pages. And basically this person said, come on, this is all, you know, the Olympics is just about the games. It's about athletes, you know, and the best athletes in the world doing all these wonderful things. If you want to protest, okay, but just go protest, get out of the way. Because, I mean, protesters, I'll quote, can still say what they want. They just can't say it where they want, you know. And it goes, well, you know, but actually the Olympics is about a lot more than just, how far you can throw a discus or a javelin. It really is about how far you can throw people into homelessness to make way for tourists and that. And I was in Vancouver during the expo years in 1986, and it was the same thing. You know, they went sweeping down into the downtown east side and those crummy hotels where people have pay exorbitant rents, but it's, you know, better than living under a bench. Of course, benches don't exist much anymore either, but you know, this is about more than just athletics. This is really about people and the effects of these big circuses, the effects that they have on them.
It is, and it would be different if they would say, okay, look, we are the Olympics. We recognize we're going into a country that has homelessness. We're going to talk about it. We're going to make it an issue. We're going to give 1% or 0.5% or something, right? But they don't. They're trying to sweep it under the rug. They're trying to clean up the streets. They're trying to make it look like it doesn't exist. And the reality is that it does exist, and it exists more and more and more with these neocon governments that are taking our tax money rather than distributing it, you know, to help so that we can help each other out.
Well, over the years, people have said, well, you know, gee, government should be run more like business, and forgetting, of course, that is the exact definition of fascism. Well, now they've got their wish. And you know, at the Olympics in Montreal in 76, it was the same thing, but they put up these big boards along the route from the airport and into the venues and stuff where, you know, the poorer neighborhoods were. They put up these big Potemkin village style, you know, clapboard with lovely paintings and designs on them and stuff. So, you know, Montrealers wouldn't be embarrassed by the poverty that their society allows. Well, sadly, listen, Janine, quickly, I'm going to go because, you know, the way things have worked out today. But your show, Winds of Change, alternating Thursdays up here at 11 a.m. At CFUV and the Street News newspaper. October's on the streets. November's on the way.
November's out, and if folks want more information about the rallies this weekend and other interesting alternative news, I'm recommending bchannelnews.tv and also the Facebook page, the 2010 Homelessness Hunger Strike Relay.
And, of course, your website, JeaneBancroft.blogspot.com, and mine, PacificFreePress.com. Okay, Jeanine, sorry to brush you off like this, but I'm going to scare up Blair Longley, and he's an interesting guy, and so I want you to stay tuned to listen to that, all right?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris. No worries.
Okay, then, until the next time. Now, as I said, I'm going to take another brief break and see if I can scare up Blair. Hold on.
What's at the top, genie, giant, orange? I should look the other way. Can't you hear the cash drop down in the fire escape? Should've medicated, could've been a helicopter hovering over me. Nothing but a torture cartoon of surgery. If you ask again, I'll make it back for you and all of us. I tried and tried and tried and tried. Commotion, spin all our heads around. Elevator going up, take it to your own eruption. Castle crumbling down. Silent at the top now, there's nobody else around. If you ask again, I'll make it back.
Welcome back to Girl Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca, shoutcast on the internet everywhere else. Spiral Beach, the only really thing. Spiral Beach, that's a new disc. Wow, I like that. Yeah, young man. Well, Bill C-6 has passed first reading in the Canadian Senate. This draconian bill is on its face, a measure to empower Health Canada in its efforts to protect Canadians from dietary supplements making bogus health claims. But the overbroad language of the bill and the over-the-top military-style raids against mom-and-pop home businesses already conducted by the RCMP have many worried. C-6 is little better than the not-so-thin wedge of the fascist state in Canada. Lord Blair Longley is an author, activist. His book titles include Megasynthesis and Letters Home from Oedipus. He's also the leader of Canada's Parti Marijuana, or Marijuana Party, and has recently written about Bill C-6 and its pernicious potential for Canadian democracy. Welcome to the program, Blair.
No, thank you.
Well, now, Blair, what exactly is Bill C-6 designed to accomplish?
Well, its title is an act respecting the safety of consumer products. And, you know, the general pattern is that public health and safety are almost always the reasons given by the immaculate hypocrites for actually doing exactly the opposite. And so, you know, the few cases of charlatans and quacks that do peddle, you know, medicines that are no good are then the basis for creating a regulatory regime that is far worse than anything else that, you know, is supposed to be prevented. These things just get recycled over and over again. The Bill C-6 comes back from before the last election as a Bill C-52, and it's now actually passed through the second reading in the Senate on October 7th and is before the Standing Committee on of the Senate for Social Affairs, Science, and Technology. And so it just, you know, it comes back from that committee in the Senate. If it's not changed, to take it back to the House of Commons, then, you know, it would be proclaimed. So, like, our best hope is that there'd be a snap election before it becomes law. Otherwise, it will become law. And as you said in the introduction, the language of the bill is so broad that it pretty well throws out all of, you know, what you would expect as civil rights to protect you against abuse of power. And so, you know, it's a pattern. It's a, you know, the more you learn about these things, the more you see the pattern, right? And I imagine, you know, a lot of your readers are already up to speed about the pattern that is manifesting more and more every day of fascist plutocracy and their agenda to, you know, accomplish their goals of a tiny minority having monopoly power. And so that's what Bill C-6 is. It's just another step towards making it possible for the big corporations to control the lives and choices of Canadian consumers and, you know, limit them to only being able to have inferior products at high prices while, you know, all the natural alternatives are discredited and destroyed, and so that people don't have those choices, and, you know, the monopolies become more and more profitable. And, you know, the key to this thing and the history of it is the vicious cycle of money and political power, and especially the funding of the political process, which becomes the worst of the vicious cycles. The greatest leverage obtained is by corrupting the political process. You know, for the least amount of money, you gain the greatest benefit of controlling, you know, what happens, right?
Well, who does benefit this? I mean, who benefits criminalizing dietary supplements? Who benefits? Now, you know, on my website, you say my readers. Well, maybe at Pacific Free Press, but certainly not in the corporate presses across this country.
No.
People probably don't know about this, but I just put up a couple of days ago a letter written by a guy named Dr. Eldon Dahl, and he relates his experience with guns drawn. The RCMP forced their way into his home and ransacked it, went through all of his personal effects, took away, he was selling from a home-based business supplements. They took all of his product. He has no access to get it back. Terrorized his wife and kids. But Bill C-6 hasn't passed. So what is this a foretelling of what we can see under 6, or how is it that they could pull this off, Health Canada could pull this off without Bill C-6 going through its final reading in the Senate?
Yeah, well, each one of these are like baby steps. The outlandish David Icke calls it the totalitarian tiptoe, you know, that each time you just take a baby step towards the fascism you know, the apocryphal story of the boiling frog, right? Mm-hmm. The boiling frog doesn't notice the slight increase in temperature. It'll jump out of hot water, but it'll just sit and cook if you gradually raise the temperature. And so basically the Canadian citizens are suffering the same consequences. The mass media are their worst enemy because they're the best professional liars and immaculate hypocrites that money can buy. And, you know, the elections are won by, you know, people who vote according to what their televisions inform them, right? And, you know, without the internet, we wouldn't hardly have a chance to even know about any of these things, you know, but still hardly possible to counter, you know, the spiral, because, like, you know, nothing's more profitable than fraud. And so once any group of people start to get away with fraud inside the context of a civilization, then they automatically become more powerful and wealthy and more able to engage in fraud. And, you know, it all tracks back, of course, to the heart of darkness, which is the monetary system itself. And then around the banksters grows up the corporations and, you know, the pharmaceuticals, the agribusiness. And, you know, it's, you know, the more you know, the worse it gets. There's this pattern. I've been, you know, working on this stuff for a few decades and have put most of my efforts into court cases against the government about the laws governing the funding of the political process. And, you know, I'm still working on that. The only thing I have to offer Canadians, Canadian taxpayers, is the use of the political contribution tax credit, because that's the only thing that a small party has. They set it up on purpose so that the big parties make money from elections while the small parties go broke. So some party like the Canadian Action Party that would, you know, be very forthright about these issues in the similar way that I speak of, you know, they're at an enormous disadvantage because of the vertical cliff at the 2% threshold. If you get 2% of the national votes, then you get most of the money you spend campaigning refunded, and you get about $2 a vote. And so all of a sudden you make money from elections. But all the small parties who might want to criticize this, they just go broke. And so, you know, it's almost always the case that you'll find that the people promoting, you know, the fascist corporatism agenda, they are got lots of money, and the people who want to oppose them are usually operating on a broken shoestring budget. And, you know, it's just a relentless grinding comes around over and over again. If they don't succeed, you know, once, they go away and come back and hit it again, you know. So, like, that's what's happened with Bill C-6 coming back, Bill C-2052 coming back as Bill C-6. It's that, you know, it's the same thing, just recycled. And, you know, without the internet, there would be like zero chance of disseminating this information and perhaps, eventually organizing more effective resistance. You know, I'm quite sure that the most important political battle probably will be whether or not the principles of the internet survive in the future, because, you know, we're lucky to have been born at a time near the creation of it, and so the original principles of the internet are still there. But if you look at the history of technology, you'll see over and over again that eventually, with any new technology, radio, television, whatever, it becomes, taken over by the big corporations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we'll have to see whether or not the internet can survive, because right now it's still the only way that we have to communicate to people outside of the mass media, which are owned and controlled by the big corporations. Like, there's about 5 corporations in Canada that own, you know, at least 80% of the ability to communicate with people. And, you know, Canada's one of the most, according to Mel Hertig anyway, Canada's one of the most concentrated media ownership places in the world. And so trying to get the message out, it seems that when it comes to food and health issues, it's more easy to get a larger group of ordinary Canadians concerned. And, you know, these particular kinds of issues have pretty big groundswells of resistance. And, you know, they've temporarily stopped these things from getting worse. Like in the United States, there was a good law that temporarily stopped these things. And, you know, it's like sort of tides, waves, they come in, you know, they go down, they come in. And Bill C-6 is like another, you know, cresting wave that will wipe out, you know, the sandcastle of our civil liberties that we were assuming were there, and, you know, leave a desolated, flattened out, you know, plain with a tiny group at the top benefiting from the monopolies that they've been able to impose, and the vast majority of people having less choice, less information, and, you know, in general, like, Europeans are way ahead of us, you know, in a lot of these things. North Americans tend to be more clueless. You know, it's an uphill battle. An up cliff battle is more like it.
I saw recently people that had moved to North America – and this was in Canada, talking about the internet, and you mentioned that the internet, you know, is sort of is free for now, but I mean, net neutrality is an issue that's still being fought in the United States, and not many know about it in Canada, but the battle lines are drawn there too about so-called throttling the speed. But these people from outside of North America were saying, God, your internet here is so slow. It's nothing like in South America or in Europe where it's very fast, but here it moves at a snail's pace. So already we're seeing that the creeping encroachment of corporate monopolization of another communication technology right here in Canada.
Yeah, you know, like it doesn't happen by accident, of course, right? They deliberately undermine it and then say, oh, we got this problem. You know, it's like you've heard all this probably before, you know, the Hegelian dialectic of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, you know, problem, reaction, solution. You know, you set up the problem on purpose and then you come forward with the solution and it turns out that it benefits the person who originally created the problem in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back into the history of these kinds of laws, you'll find that, you know, the extremely wealthy people in the United States funded the study to, you know, reveal that there was quacks and charlatans running the medical profession and that it needed to be fixed up, which was true. And then they used that to gradually take control of all the medical schools by funding them. So they give, you know, an endowment to the various universities and they say, oh, you should appoint this person as the chairman of your department, right? And so, like, throughout the 20th century, there was this relentless agenda that gradually took over medical research and education and, you know, the food industry, and it's just picking up speed faster and faster now, and we're in the 21st century, and you know, it's a race between that kind of ability to control people with ignorance and fear versus, you know, having more, you know, information and awareness. And, you know, not long ago, it would only have been a tiny group of intellectuals that would have known anything about anything that we're talking about. But now anybody who wants to wade through, you know, all the other bullshit can actually find out about this stuff. You know, like you referred to my article on the Marijuana Party website about Bill C-6, and I have links, you know, to all kinds of videos and other articles, you know, that will give you background information about Codex Alimentarius,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the structure of the Windsor Cartel, you know, the about five huge corporations, a couple of which are privately owned, that dominate like 80-90% of the food business in the world and turn food into a weapon. And so, you know, it's basically the fulfillment of a society that is a social pyramid, and the, you know, it's a sophisticated form of slavery. There's a tiny group at the top and the vast majority at the bottom. And if you look at the shape of that social pyramid, since it's the triumph of dishonesty backed up with violence, proportions have become like something you would expect out of a cartoon, but they're actually the real statistical facts. So the social pyramid now, it used to be kind of broad-based, right? Like a statistic would be, you know, a few decades ago, say 50 years ago, the difference between how much money, you know, this chief executive officer of a corporation and the ordinary worker would be a ratio of about 1 to 20. And now it's a ratio of about 1 to 400.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pyramid has been getting steeper and steeper. And shooting up out of the top of the social pyramid has been this antenna or like an oil gushing well that, you know, if you try and graph it out, it doesn't fit on the graph because the base of the pyramid can't be compared to this antenna that, like, goes up through the stratosphere into outer space. So, you know, if you really do enough research into all this, what you come to as an overgeneralized kind of conclusion is that there's a group of people that collectively are trillionaire mass murderers who control our civilization. And, you know, they have their tentacles going throughout all of it, and they have a relentless agenda, and they are accomplishing it, but at the same time, more than any other time in the past, people are waking up to this, and anybody who wants to find out has access to information that they would have never been able to have access to before, because, you know, their local library would never have it, their mass media would certainly never tell them about it, right? So only the alternative media, which you can access through the Internet, it's the only place you can find out about this stuff. And it's relatively recent, and it hasn't yet accomplished anything significant in terms of changing the political process to have a different outcome, but it has the potential to do that. So the battle now is to try and, you know, wake up more people. And when it comes to something as basic as food and health, you tend to have an easier time to do that than almost any other issue.
Well, Blair Longley, leader of the Marijuana Party of Canada, the information you're talking about can be, some of it at least can be accessed at your party's website, www.marijuanaparty.ca. We can only fight our battles 1 hour at a time here at Guerrilla Radio, Blair, and that hour is up. But I thank you for coming on and welcome you to your new residence here in our fair province of British Columbia.
Okay. Thanks. Nice talking to you, Chris.
All right. Bye for now. Bye. And I want to also thank Ann Jones and Janine Bancroft and Zoe Blunt. Check it out. Also go to pacificfreepress.com sometime later tonight. I'll archive this program as a podcast, as I do all my shows. I want to remind you to stick around, especially if you're a jazz fan, because coming straight up is Rhythm and Ing with Arnold. And that's all I've got for this week.